It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome back to Money for Lunch. Good to have you here. You know, earlier this week I had said something in reference to if you want to change your life, you can. It starts by changing your standards, right? And I had a couple of people send me a message saying that that wasn't really true. It wasn't really, you know, an answer. The reality is it's probably not the answer they wanted. Look, once you make a decision that you're no longer going to tolerate a certain activity, either in yourself or in other people, your life changes. So if you're no longer going to tolerate smoking, you've had enough, you're tired of that, you will stop smoking. We've seen it with people who are addicted to heroin. They hit, quote, rock bottom, and then they stop. They no longer will tolerate it. We've seen obese people who were completely unhealthy and unfit, and then they do that 180, and they leave it all behind because they've changed their standard, right? It isn't outside pressure. There is no out there. It's all coming from inside. The difference between you taking action and not taking action is that for you to take action, for you to make this change, for you to do this thing, it is a must. It's an absolute must. It's a standard that drives you and nothing else. And once you change those standards, then everything else changes. Anyway, if you agree with me, great. If you don't agree with me, great. Love to get your insights. And either way, Bert, you can hit me up at on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram. Just look up Bert Martinez and love to connect with you there. But let's get the party started. I'm excited for my next guest. I was just talking to him a few minutes before the show. His name is Gerald Posner. Gerald Posner is an attorney, author of 12 investigative nonfiction books. The subjects range from Nazi war criminals to political assassination to 9/11, as well as business stories like the history of Motown Records. His latest is 2015, God's Bankers, the story of the Vatican Bank and a modern history of money in the Vatican. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer in History for his 1993 book, Case Closed, about the JFK assassination. God's Bankers and others have been New York Times bestsellers. He writes regularly for national magazines and appears as a guest frequently on news programs, including CNN, Fox News, NBC. Gerald Posner, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Bert, great to be with you.
I'm excited. As I was saying before, here you are. You've done 12 investigative books, nonfiction books. That's a huge amount of work. As you were telling me, it takes you a lot of time to go through this process and create and go through the investigative process. So my hat's off to you. That's such an impressive amount of books.
Well, and you know, the fun that I have with this, and you gave a little bit of this in the introduction, but that I like to, and I'm very, very lucky with publishers over the years, with originally McGraw-Hill and then Random House and then most recently with Simon & Schuster, to find publishers that allow me to move on to completely different subjects. Because as writers, so often, publishers find out what your wheelhouse is and they want you to stay in it. So if you're writing books on the intelligence world and spies and the CIA, they like you. If you have a bestseller, gee, they say you've been on the New York Times, let's stay in that field and do a follow-up. Same thing if you're writing investigative books about the pharmaceutical industry or sports or whatever else. And I tend to, I work with my wife, Tricia, who's also an author. We work on these projects together, and I learn everything I can about a given subject, whether it's, let's say, it's Motown Records or an assassination, or in one case it was about heroin traffickers in Southeast Asia. And then just at the point when I publish the book, and I'm now up to speed when I'm almost a quasi-expert, then I go to the publisher and I say, I'd like to leave that field and do something I know nothing at all about and go to another field because this sounds like a tempting topic. And they've been crazy enough to let me do it, and I've been crazy enough to sort of recreate the wheel from the ground up. So that's the fun of this, is that I keep moving on to very, very different subjects. Like you said, the last one was money in the Vatican. So you know the sure bet is that the next book won't have anything to do with the Vatican.
I love that. Well, you know what? And this is where, as an attorney, I think that this probably helps you, because as an attorney, I, in a former life, went to law school and graduated, and I remember that you learn to really enjoy doing investigative or research type of work and compiling the data, and sometimes they lead you down rabbit holes and whatever, but I think that probably gives you an edge, that you have that skill, that discipline from being an attorney, that you're able to bring that laser focus to these different subjects that intrigue you.
Boy, you know, Bert, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it might be because, you know, you went through law school, so you understand that discipline. And I always like to say, I mean, I guess in some ways you or me, we're everybody's favorite type of attorney, because we're not practicing. You know, you're doing your career, I'm doing writing. So we've moved away from law, but you do learn that ability to delve into the documents and to delve into the evidence and the research. And so a lot of the time I'm off doing interviews with people that for 6 months say no, they don't want to talk, and then finally they agree to talk. Or I'm in on the last book on the Vatican, we were in the archives in Romania and Poland. We found the files of a big German insurance company that they thought had been destroyed in the war, in a warehouse in northern Italy. So, you know, and the more documents, the better. It's also great if, as a reporter or a journalist, and this isn't the case a lot of times nowadays, publishers for books like to know what your conclusion is before you start. And that's something I've never been able to give, because I don't know it until I start to do the research. I sort of follow the evidence. It takes me to where it's going to take me. So the publisher has to have faith that I'm going to come up with a reasonable book that actually makes sense and has something new in it. But if you go out to just prove what you already believe, that's easy to do. You just go out and you do the interviews that fit with your thesis of something, and you fit the evidence into what you have. But if you really want to go out and just sort of, you know, follow the evidence, it does help having that legal background. I agree.
Absolutely. All right, so let's get into this. You're what? Hanging around and boom, lightning hits you. What prompted you? What motivated you to write a book about not just money, but about money in the Vatican?
Well, like so many projects that come up, they end up coming up not because you sit down and you think to yourself, this is what I'd like to do as a book. It becomes that over a period of time. And the Vatican book was a perfect example, because in the mid-80s, on my very, very first book, when I was still practicing law, I was doing a pro bono lawsuit on behalf of some survivors of a concentration camp from Auschwitz who had been experimented on by Joseph Mengele, the so-called Angel of Death, the doctor from Auschwitz. They've made movies on him, Boys from Brazil and Marathon Man. And at that time, we thought he was still alive. I was suing Germany. We got thrown out of federal court. But in the process of doing that, I traveled to Argentina. I went to Paraguay, where Mengele had been hiding. And I got access by persistence and luck to the Argentine federal police files on Mengele, this Nazi fugitive. And in those files was a file marked Martin Bormann. And that was Hitler's secretary. There had been rumors that he had been missing for years. And I tried to get it. They wouldn't give it to me. And the long and short of it is we fought for years back and forth with the Argentines over that file. In that file eventually was information that priest in the Vatican and a bishop helped some of the Nazis escape justice after the war. And I thought to myself, you know, I'd like to go back and look at that at some point. And then I did other books. I did books on, you know, Kennedy. I did books on Motown, 9/11. And finally, in 2005, I proposed to Simon Schuster a book about the escape networks of the Nazis after the war and the Vatican, whether it was a freelance program or sanctioned by the church. And that grew as I started to do the research. into not that. That wasn't the story. The story was instead, I should have known it, follow the money. And so instead it became a book about money in the Vatican, and then it went from becoming a World War II book to becoming a 200-year history of money in the Vatican up to the current time. And I was so slow in finishing it. This book went on and off for 9 years that one pope left office and another pope came in, so I published under Francis instead of under Benedict, and it turned out to be all right.
Nine Never, years.
You
That's
have to
incredible.
Be flexible with your plans. That's right.
I love that. Yes, you have to be flexible with your plan. You know, okay, so it seems like coming up with the information was not easy. I mean, it seemed like you had some definite challenges.
Yeah, well, you know, so you always go for the most direct way of doing it. In this case, that was getting help from the Vatican, because they have not released almost any of their World War II files. They, 75 years later, they still have them sealed. I actually have written two op-eds, one in the Los Angeles Times and one in the Washington Post this past year, asking the Vatican to release those files, but they haven't. And when I asked for them, they sort of told me the same thing they told everyone else, which is get lost. And so they just closed the door on me. I went to Rome a couple of times. I was able to get some good interviews, but for the most part, they just made sure that I didn't get inside. And that meant I had to do it the harder way, like you said. I had to go outside, and the Vatican Bank was my key focus. That's an institution, sort of like, I guess, you know, you have in the business world, it's the cross between like the Federal Reserve and Goldman Sachs and Citibank all rolled into one for this little country in the middle of Italy. And so the Vatican Bank was formed in the middle of World War II. And what I did is I went out and found all the entities it had done business with over the years, the insurance companies, the banks, the multinationals, and I went through their archives, their records, their government files to pull out the history of the Vatican Bank. And that made it possible to tell a story that had never been told before.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, and I want to read this. The Chicago Tribune says Posner is a merciless pit bull of an investigator marshaling mountains of evidence to make his arguments. So is that one of the reasons why it took you 9 years? Because it was such a slow process getting all the stuff together?
Yeah, I mean, it was it was one of the reasons, although I did a book in between on the history of Miami Beach. If I hadn't done that book, I probably would have been able to wrap the Vatican up in four and a half, something like that. But still, it was a slow process. And when I say four and a half years, that's from the very beginning, let's say, that you sign a contract, you do the research and the reporting, you gather at the end of your research and reporting, after a couple of years or 2.5 years, you may have 200 interviews with, like, you know, 1,200 or 1,300 hours of interviews. Some of them are garbage and not useful, and some are incredibly useful. Some are on the record, some are off the record. And then you have a small room filled with documents and microfiche and microfilm and hard drives filled with digital copies now of documents. And in the mass of that, you figure out what the story is. And that's something I've always been good at, is having this, you know, mountain of documents and then saying, okay, here's the story to tell. And the story that I end up telling isn't the only story that could be told from all that evidence. Somebody else, you might come into it, go through it all, and decide to tell the story a different way. So, you know, it's not a better or worse way. There's just different ways to tell that story. And at the end, you go through the process of finishing that manuscript, writing it up, and getting it through the editor. That takes the 4 to 5 years. So it's slow, but it's an everyday job. There are no shortcuts.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I've learned that.
All right, talk about this. Tell us about the mystery death and the offshore banking stories about the Vatican. Talk about this.
Oh, well, I mean, the book starts off with a newspaper clerk in London going to work in 1982 to the Daily Express, this newspaper, and as he's wandering along the River Thames, he looks up at early in the morning and he sees like a shadow, and he rubs his eyes. He's not quite sure what it is. It's actually a body dangling from underneath Blackfriars Bridge, hanging by its neck, And they call the police, and Scotland Yard comes in, and that turns out to be a missing fugitive, this Italian banker, one of the biggest bankers in all of Italy at the time. And he had been doing business with the Vatican Bank, Roberto Calvi. They had been looking for him. And Calvi, it turns out, was involved in hundreds of millions of dollars of fraud with these offshore accounts with the Vatican Bank, with a Monsignor and then Bishop who were running the bank. And Scotland Yard does an inquest, and they say, he's hanging underneath the bridge. He would have had to walk up like 18 feet over these rocks. He had vertigo. He wasn't very good at heights. He would have had to twist himself around and tie a rope around his neck at the same time he was balancing himself on this 4-inch ledge. We think it's suicide. And they wrote it off as suicide. It's unbelievable. It took 25 years for an inquest to finally turn it over as murder. And if that's not bad, there's another fellow called, Nicola Sindona, who was one of the leading industrialists. He was also with the Vatican Bank in the 70s and 80s doing all types of shenanigans in business. He bought Franklin National Bank here in America. It was the biggest bankruptcy at the time when it went under. And when Sindona was eventually convicted for all of his misdeeds with the Vatican and for trying to kill the prosecutor who had opened a criminal investigation into him, they sentenced him to jail in Italy. They extradited him from the U.S., and they were so afraid that somebody might try to kill Sindona that, Bert, they actually built a special part of this prison called Rubina Prison. It's a wing. It's a single room for him, and his food is brought to him is prepared in a special part of the kitchen, then it's sealed in containers. It's brought to him by a guy. It's opened up by another person. They had video cameras on him, guards around the clock. His second day in prison, he grabs at his throat and goes, "I've been poisoned," and it turns out he was. He dies of cyanide right there before he can spill any of the beans about all his co-conspirators, and the Italians investigated and say, suicide. It's fantastic. So yet another suicide is written off as cyanide poisoning in the jail. So the two biggest bankers who did business with the Vatican Bank and were involved, that I go through chapters of misdeeds and just things that will make your eyes roll, both end up, one hanging under a London bridge and the other cyanide poisoning in an Italian jail. But remember, suicides.
Sure. So, okay, so the London hanging, what year is this?
82. So what I say is the Vatican Bank was founded in 42, and I live in Miami, so I often refer to the worst period for something, whether I'm talking about the war against terror or whether I'm talking about financial misdeeds, as the cocaine cowboy days, because those were the worst days in Miami when things were the most out of control.
Yeah.
in the criminal underworld. So the cocaine cowboy days for the Vatican Bank were the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. Before that, it wasn't really involved as much as an offshore bank for the mafia as it was doing sort of secret deals for the church itself. So it was formed in the middle of the war, and what they used it for, we were in the middle of the war, we're fighting the Nazis, and the U.S. Treasury Department is trying to catch countries doing business with the enemy. Trading with the enemy is a big crime. The Vatican was neutral. It's a country. It's technically neutral. So we put, in the U.S., we put Switzerland on the blacklist because we found out they were dealing with Germany. We put San Marino, Monaco, all of those little tiny countries were put on the blacklist. The only one that wasn't was the Vatican. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the Vatican Bank was doing all types of investments with the Germans because what they were doing was smart business. It may not have been very moral, but it was smart business. They were hedging their bets. They didn't know who was going to win the war. So they invested with the Americans, they invested with the British, and they invested with the Germans. Then when they saw the war going bad in 43 and 44, they pulled out all their German investments. And when the war was over, they said, hey, we only invested with the winning side. And nobody could prove otherwise because it was all hidden in the bank. And then over time, the bank becomes sort of this great offshore bank. Your listeners will have heard about offshore banks in the Caymans or the Bahamas or Hong Kong, or you heard about the Panama Papers recently. Well, the Vatican Bank has all the earmarks of an offshore bank because it's absolute secrecy. There was no law against money laundering in Vatican City until just 5 years ago. And it's in the heart of Rome. So what I mean by that is if you're sending illegal money to an offshore bank in the Bahamas or the Caymans or Panama, you have to wire the money. With the Vatican Bank, it's literally sitting on a two-thirds mile square plot of land in the center of the Italian capital that happens to be another country. So, Bert, it would be as if Times Square, for those people who are listening who have been to New York City and have been to Times Square, think of 42nd Street to 47th Street, the heart of Times Square, as a separate country. If it was a separate country and had its own bank, and you lived outside of that country on like 39th Street, but you could get two suitcases with $1 million to a friend who lived inside the Times Square country, the minute he took that money and deposited it into their bank, it disappeared from the IRS, it disappeared from New York State tax regulators, it disappeared from the SEC, from everything. And that's why the Vatican Bank became such a great offshore bank for mobsters who were looking to hide money, for businessmen who wanted to avoid paying taxes and everything, because it was just sitting there waiting to be had.
This is so incredible, too. You know, well, I think what makes it so incredible is, as you pointed out, this is God's bankers. This is the Vatican, and it just seems like this is something that would be that they would want to stay away from this. I want to get your thoughts on this because we're short on time. Let's see, Pope Francis, has he made any kind of – you mentioned that they made some reform with what do you call it? Do you think that he's going to continue to make more reforms, or do you think it's going to be, depending on how much scandal they get into, what's your best guess?
I think that he is really the new sheriff in town, and he is shaking things up. And, you know, I'm a Catholic kid. I went to grammar school with Sisters of Charity and then Jesuits for high school. I was an altar boy. And so I sort of always have the hope that somebody at the top of the church is going to turn things around. And when he first came in, I was skeptical because he said what every previous pope has said, which is, I'm going to clean up the finances. And then they all get quagmired into this mess with the bureaucrats who run the bank. But he has really done it. He brought in outsiders. He had auditors come in from independent firms. He brought in people that were going to enforce the laws. He passed for the first time laws against money laundering, as I said before, and against how much cash could be brought into the city. So I think that if he is in power, he's 80 now almost, he's in power for another 3 to 4 years, he will have passed enough laws that going forward, it's just going to be a boring mid-level community bank. The wild, crazy days will be history.
The cowboy days are gone.
That's right.
Gerald,
I believe that's true. I believe that's true.
Yeah. I can't wait to bring you back. You have 12 investigative books. That's at least 11 more interviews. But this interview here, really, we need at least another hour because this is so interesting. The book, again, is called God's Bankers, and let me give you the full title because it's A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. God's Banker, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican, available on Amazon as well as Simon & Schuster. Gerald, thank you so much for stopping by. Can't wait to have you back.
Bert, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having a chance to chat with you and your listeners.
You bet. Good stuff there from Gerald Posner. New York Times bestselling author, 12 investigative nonfiction books, and you can tell the depth that he goes into that from start to finish. This last book took him 9 years. Anyway, cool stuff. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Kathy Fetke, CEO and founder of Real Wealth Network, based in Walnut Creek, California, an organization dedicated to helping members get the most current and cutting-edge education and information they need to succeed as real estate investors. Kathy's a licensed realtor, former mortgage broker, and an active real estate investor. She was selected as one of America's 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs by Goldman Sachs at the first annual and second annual Builders and Innovators Summit. Kathy Fetke, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you so much.
You know what? It's good to have you here. And, I want to kind of, start off by asking you this. Real quick, Brexit's impact on the U.S. real estate market, do you think it's going to be a deal or no deal? What is your thought overall?
The effect of Brexit, well, so far has dropped interest rates here in the U.S. It's probably due to a lot of global uncertainty, but we just had, the U.S. 10-year Treasury drop to all-time lows, and that also is, mortgage-backed securities usually have the same, the same thing goes on. So we saw mortgage rates drop, and that makes real estate a little bit more affordable for people, but it also can drive a bigger bubble. So you got to be careful with that. But people who've been trying to buy that house and maybe couldn't can maybe do it now. And people buying investment property are going to get better cash flow because interest rates are lower, at least for right now.
Sure, sure. Well, let me ask you this. You have high-end homes. It seems like that market is slowing down a little bit. And then affordable housing seems to be on the rise. Talk about that. Is this just normal market flow? What's your thought?
No, nothing's normal today. Everything's manipulated. So, there are normal market cycles, and yes, that's true. Part of this is normal, where in a normal cycle, people get excited about buying any kind of asset, real estate, gold, stocks, whatever, when prices are going up. And so, why wouldn't you? You jump in, there's been a history of prices going up, it looks good. Until it gets to the top, and usually that's when the masses come in. It's just, it's happened for thousands of years. Humans don't seem to get it. But for some reason, once prices are at their peak, that's when 80% of people jump in and buy. Because they just, falsely believe that it's going to continue always going up. It never does. And so at that point, there's usually something that tips. And it could be the stock market goes down, or it could be the interest rates go up, or, we have an economic slowdown, and so people lose jobs. Whatever it is, something would prick that bubble. Could be that builders came in and built too much property in the case of real estate, and it just hit a point where there wasn't enough demand. And then we cycle back down, right? And then when prices hit the bottom, when people should be buying, when they're the cheapest, again, whether it's oil, gas, real estate, they don't. It's only those who can really understand the fundamentals of that investment who jump in and buy everything they can. But then as prices go up because the smart money's bought everything, then, again, it's the same cycle. So where are we? You ask. we're kind of,
yes.
It depends. There's some markets where we've clearly topped and it's already slowing down. The bubble's already been pierced, but the air's just coming out ever so slowly right now. But then there's other markets in real estate where it's still really strong. The fundamentals are there. It all makes sense. There's job growth, population growth, supply and demand are in check, and the cash flow is fantastic. So, those are the markets you want to be in if you're buying real estate.
And I want to talk about this because I thought what you brought up was kind of interesting, and I think it separates, I don't want to say sophisticated investors, but maybe that's the best choice, or at least experienced investors might be a better choice. When you made that remark about investors or people not buying at an all-time low, they tend to buy when it's high and sell when it's low. And I think a lot of that is because they're waiting, right? They have that fear. And by the time they get over that fear and they're ready to pull the trigger, the market's up, so they buy. And, of course, now the market, as it should, cycles back down. And of course, now they see their fears realized. Oh, this is exactly what I was afraid of, and I shouldn't have done this, instead of just, either buying more when the price is low or holding on.
Right. Yep. That's right. Yep, people are, well, it just often comes to a lack of education. People are busy. They don't have time to research the things that they invest in. And so they just look at, oh, well, you know, so-and-so bought there or got that and it worked for them, so I'm going to do that. You know, I had somebody, literally a friend of mine in Malibu, who saw that, read one report on Apple stocks were going to go up, and he put $1 million into the Apple stock, and it went down, you know, 10%, like the next day. It was like, oh, did you know what to look for, what to base that decision on? And so, yeah, I know, it's amazing, and I'm not saying that Apple stock is terrible.
No, the reason I'm laughing is because my experience, my mindset when I buy any stock is it's going to go down the minute I buy it. So you know you have to buy for the long haul, because it's like, yeah, I know it's going to go down. It's just sometimes the way it is. But if you like Apple, if you understand Apple, if you really believe in Apple, and you lose 10%, that's not a big deal because it's going to come back.
Well, you know, hopefully it may or may not. There are a lot of oil stocks that may never come back. There are a lot of bank stocks that may never come back. There's some REITs that are not going to do well because life does change and the world does change. You have to pay attention. So if you're in shopping mall REITs, you should be careful because there's more online shopping happening and they're struggling. If you're in any kind of European bank, oh my goodness, get out. I mean, I don't know if it's ever coming back. Maybe, but you might have to wait a long time. So, and you're
well,
right.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention, it's funny you should mention the shopping malls. I think the last two or three or four articles I've read about shopping malls is that a lot of them are struggling to be profitable, just because like you said, there are a lot more people are buying online. And Amazon is making it tougher for them. I mean, Amazon now can with some products, can get them to you the same day. A lot of their products are brought to you the next day, and I think 100% of their products are delivered to you within 3 days. So it's pretty tough to be a mall and keep it cranked, you know, keep it crowded, keep it full. It's getting more
Absolutely. And
more difficult.
I can't remember the last time I went to one. I mean, you know, for proms for the past, I don't know, 50 years, you go get your prom dress at the mall. But here in Malibu, I don't know one girl who did. They all bought online, all of them. So, you know,
things are changing. Since you brought up the prom, I know several girls who rented their gown online.
Right. Yeah. I mean, then that is becoming even more common, is sharing, you know, sharing assets. So the Airbnbs of the world, and, you know, they even have shared car. You can own a car and park it at the airport and someone else can drive it while you're gone. You don't have to pay for parking while you're traveling, and you get to rent it out to someone who needs it. So, I mean, there's so much change happening. You have to pay attention. Whatever you're investing in, don't think that because the last 10 years or 20 years or 30 years it did something, that it's going to do that again. And the biggest thing that's changing, there's two big things. Technology's changing, but demographics. So we have the baby boomers have driven the economy for the past 50 years, but they're retiring. So they're pulling their money out. They're not investing in the stock market like they did. They're pulling it out to retire on. And they're not buying houses. They're downsizing the number of baby boomers now renting is increasing rapidly. They don't want to even deal with home ownership, a lot of them. So, you can't really be watching the baby boomers so much to decide what's going to boom. You've got to look at their kids, the millennials. And if we pay attention to them, we'll really understand they're going to do the same thing the baby boomers did. Whatever they buy is going to boom, basically. So what are they buying? Are they going to malls? Of course not. You know, no, they're not. So we've got to pay attention. When it comes to real estate, it's the same thing. So what are they buying? Where are they living? Where are the jobs? And if we follow that, we can really make a killing, because there's parts of the country that are not overbought or overpriced yet when it comes to real estate. There's areas in the U.S. where there's job growth and population growth, but you can still buy a house for under $100,000 and get over $1,000 in rent, get a double-digit return on cash flow, and the prices are still not anywhere close to where they were at the last high. So there's room for growth. But then you go to San Francisco or Seattle or Denver or L.A. or New York, Miami, And if you buy today, it's a guarantee you're going to lose money. I can guarantee you. You won't get cash flow and you won't get appreciation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is the difference. This is the reason why if you are looking at investing in real estate, which I think is a smart move, you need to connect with somebody who knows what they're doing and can help you avoid some of these pitfalls, investing in the wrong place like New York or Miami or San Francisco. Right now, I could see that, being a horrible, horrible idea unless you're in the exceptional few who might get some ridiculous deal because you're in the right place at the right time. So let's talk about this. Where it comes to, we've been talking a little bit about bubbles here and there. Do you see areas that have a bubble? You mentioned New York, San Francisco, Miami. Those are the areas that you see the biggest, potential for a bubble pop?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and especially now that's, to answer your earlier question about Brexit, a lot of investors worldwide who were buying, real estate in the UK, they're coming to the US now. So, foreign money is desperate to just find a place to invest. They were buying negative bonds and in Europe. So, they were happy to just lose a little money instead of a lot of money, putting it in bond. I mean, it's crazy. Who buys a negative bond? But so when you come to the U.S. and you can overpay for a property and get a 2% return versus a negative, then that sounds good to you. And so, but that doesn't sound good to me. You don't want 2% in real estate because there's too many unknowns. You need to be getting 8 to 12% minimum. And that's net. I'm not talking, I hear a lot of these, slick salespeople saying, you'll get a 12% return, but that's gross. You subtract the expenses, you should be getting between 8 and 12%. And so with foreign money coming in.
I think that if you were happy with a 1 or 2% return, you could just leave it, leave it in some of these, bonds or some of these other instruments that are going to guarantee a 1 or 2% return, and you have nothing to really lose because you're not gaining a whole lot. All right, so you're saying that, hey, in a good real estate investment, you should get between 12 and 18% return net?
Yeah, because there are parts of the country where the foreclosure crisis isn't over. So they have their judicial states where every foreclosure had to go through the court system, and there's just not enough judges to deal with the incredible amount of foreclosures we had over the last 10 years. And so certain parts of Florida, Ohio, Indiana, it's kind of the flyover states, I guess you could say, but areas that have, strong job growth. There's parts of Ohio that's got really strong job growth, but the home prices have not gone up, but rents have. So in those areas, you can still get double-digit returns for sure. And if you get a loan, then you can get, 15 to 20% return if you're not paying cash. So it's an incredible – and again, that's net. After all expenses. So there's incredible opportunity in real estate. That's what we help people do at Real Wealth Network every day is, like, here's the data, here's the markets, here's where the jobs are going, here's where the population's going, and then we help them find the, properties that are all done for you, rent-ready, so that, you can own a rental with property management in place. Don't go out and hear what I say because people get excited because I'm excited and find something online or just hire the next realtor or friend and think that they're going to understand investment property. It does not work that way. You've got to work with a specialist who understands investment property because most real estate agents don't. They specialize in primary residences and helping you find your home, but they don't know property management and the things required
right.
for that. So be careful.
Matter of fact, I can tell you that from my own experience, I learned it the hard way. Most real estate agents are not real estate investors. They've never done that. They don't know what they're doing in that area.
Yep.
I have found very few real estate agents who actually have that real estate investor background, and those are great people to hook up with, but they're far and few between. And again, there's nothing wrong if you just want to buy a residence that you're going to keep, then just about any real estate agent will probably help you with that. But if you're looking to to find somebody who knows about investment properties. That's a different animal altogether. Let me ask you this real quick, because triggered something for me, and that is, hey, when you said don't get excited because I'm excited and start, you know, buying stuff or doing stuff. Obviously, you've already covered some of the pitfalls. You may be connected with somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. What are some of the other pitfalls? What are some of the other ways that people are losing money with real estate today?
What are some ways they're losing?
Yes.
Money? Yeah. Oh, gosh. You know, again, buying at the peak, not knowing that, you know, that the high end is already softening. But I don't think most people aren't doing that. It's usually, you know, overseas foreign investors from China who've got lots of money to blow. But that's one way. Another way is giving your money to a contractor and giving it up front. So if you buy a property, you got a great deal on it, and you hire a contractor and you give him the money up front, where is the incentive for him to get that done? Never do that. Never. Always.
Never.
Give a little bit. Yeah, never. But people do it all the time. It's amazing. Never buy a property without an inspection. I've seen so many times, you know, some sociopath sell somebody, some innocent person, a property saying, oh, you don't need to get an inspection. I did an inspection, or here, you know, I did this, whatever, you know. No, you get a third party inspection, get an appraisal, third party. Don't trust the seller's appraisal. Don't trust the seller on anything. Honestly, they're trying to sell the property. So, you know, you've got to get the support you need. So those are some ways. The worst thing is buying anything you don't understand. So if you buy, I had somebody say, oh, I hate real estate, I'll never do it again. I said, why? Well, I bought this property online and I can't rent it. Well, why can't you rent it? Oh, it turns out it's an hour from town. Really? Well, he's like, but it looks like such a good deal. You know, no, there's a reason why there's good deals out there. You've got to not be lazy when it comes to real estate. A lot of people get really lazy and they want to trust somebody else to just do all the work for them. You've still got to do your due diligence. And we've got a whole due diligence checklist to give people, a buying checklist, a property management checklist. These are things you've got to do to protect yourself. But if you do and you work with the right teams, you can truly build wealth and long-term wealth. This is an opportunity of a lifetime still in certain markets because the rental demand is increasing rapidly. There's so much demand for rental property. People can't get loans. They can't afford houses. They want to rent. And this millennial generation, that's 87 million millennials or something like that, they're all coming to age, leaving mom and dads, and they're going out and they're going to rent. So there's a wonderful opportunity. Yeah.
Absolutely. And as you said earlier, some of these people don't want to buy. They're not buyers. They're renters. They prefer the flexibility of renting. I love the rental market. And Kathy, where can they go to get more information? Is it Wealth Network, realwealthnetwork.com?
You got it, realwealthnetwork.com. It's free to join, and we'll give you all that data on markets and the checklist. And you can also get my book, Retire Rich with Rentals, on Amazon.
Retire Rich on Rentals. I love it. Kathy Fetke, always good to have you here. Looking forward to have you back again soon. Kathy Fetke, and again, guys, check her out at realwealthnetwork.com. It's free to join. Kathy, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, guys, good stuff there about what's happening in real estate. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Then we come back. Then we'll be right back. Right.
Welcome back
this.
To Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro.
And
and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right,
it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. Jackie Bashira on the show. Larry Shaliga will be joining us momentarily. He's dialing back in. We're just trying to get a better connection. So we're going to wait on that for a couple more seconds, and I'm excited to get these two guys on the show and kind of get some of their insights and story real quick. I'll tell you a little bit about our first guest, our next guest, Larry Shaliga, is the founder and CEO of Results Oriented Coaching and Consulting, an organization providing training, coaching, and consulting services dedicated to helping others reach their highest potential. Larry has kind of a really neat background. Larry has a remarkable 40-year career in a variety of private-owned and publicly traded companies. He previously worked as a director of quality improvement at Chevrolet Pontiac and GMC of Canada, where he created and facilitated trust-building workshops between upper GM management and the United Auto Workers. That's not an easy thing to do. Also joining me is Jackie Bashira. She's helped individuals, teams, and groups transform their thinking and behavior for more than 20 years. Jackie is an evidence-based, results-oriented organizational development consultant, an executive coach specializing in transformational learning, mindset recognition, and development and group dynamics. She relies on well-researched and validated theories to develop practical and powerful strategic interventions for her clients. Larry and Jackie, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. Really glad
Hi,
to
Bert.
Be here, Bert.
Hey, Larry. Boy, you sound good. A lot better. That's great. Well, good to have you here, Jackie. And Larry, good to have you back.
Good.
I'm
glad to hear that.
so let's talk about this. Let's start with you, Larry, because you've had this very successful career, and kind of give us a snippet of your background. I know you've worked with large and small, publicly traded as far as, and also privately owned companies. So talk about that.
Well, as you said, I worked for General Motors for about 10 years. I ended up as Director of Quality Improvement for Chevrolet, Pontiac, and GM of Canada, and did a lot of trust-building workshops between union and upper management. The goal was to go into the plants that were not doing well. These were the assembly plants, looking for those who were in the lower portion of their performance criteria. We were very lucky, and in almost all cases, 5 out of 6 that we tried, we were able to take them to the top 3 within 24 months. Left General Motors, started my own consulting business, worked with GM, Ford, Chrysler, Toyota, GE Medical, Westinghouse Oceanic, and Colgate Palmolive, to name a few, and did that for quite some time. Then went back into corporate America to a small company, was doing about $10 million in sales, $10 million in debt, and long story short, right now they're doing close to $300 million. So
wow.
That was the story. Yeah, it was quite exciting. And the part that was interesting, Bert, was that I always felt successful. But suddenly, this was so about 5 years ago, the wheels came off. I just couldn't seem to do anything right. I was working, found myself doing what everybody else would do. I started working a lot harder, working a lot longer hours. Still didn't get the job done, but I did manage to spend less time with my family, friends, and doing the things that I like to do. I got to tell you, it's extremely frustrating, and the harder I worked, the worse it seemed to get. Put together a resume because I decided that it was the place that I was working that was affecting my ability to succeed. So put together a real nice resume and even sat down and described the company that I wanted to work for. The scary part was that after I described it, found out that I was already working there. So if it wasn't the people I was working for, the people I was working with, and everybody else, the only person left was me. That's a scary thought.
So, all right, so I'm going to put a pause on that, and let me come over here to Jackie. So, Jackie, tell us what you do. How are your strategies helping people like myself and like Larry and other CEOs and executives? Talk about what you do.
So I work as an executive coach and an organization development consultant. And, Bert, I'm going to step back for just a moment and share with you that before I began doing this work, I did national and international news for the Associated Press and the broadcast division. And I started as a 9-month temp on the overnight desk and worked my way up to being a part of the news team. And then I was a radio anchor on the network and then became a supervisor and eventually was put in charge of the entire radio/audio division. And what captured my attention is at every level that I went up in the organization, the complaints from everybody around were the same. People didn't feel understood. Everybody felt like they had more to do with less. A sense of an us and them rather than us working together. And I decided to go back to school because another issue that comes up a lot of times in organizations is people who are good technically are then promoted into a management position, a leadership position, but they don't have a leadership mindset. And so the work I did as a journalist was very different than the work I needed to do as head of a division to bring people together. So I decided to go back to school, and I got a master's in organization development and just fell in love with the idea of helping people develop and grow in their organizations because we spend so much time in our organizations. And after I got my first master's, I decided to continue with the education process. I took a course in executive coaching, got certified as an executive coach. Currently, I'm a PhD candidate working in human and organization systems because what I'm really interested in is the human component within organizations. So now to get to your question, which is what is it that I do, I feel like what I do is to help people to build bridges and remove obstacles in terms of what might be in the way of them achieving whatever are their goals, their potential, what they're looking to achieve, and really trying to bring the best out in people through both a supportive way, through providing feedback. You asked in the beginning section, you talked about being a goals-oriented coach using well-validated theories and research. I'm probably, from my journalistic background, I always say I'm kind of a born skeptic. So I always want to know, if you're giving me feedback on something, do you know what you're talking about? And how do you know? How do you know this works? So part of what I do is use theories and best practices that have been shown to work, have worked for others, and then adapt them to who it is I'm talking to fit the needs of the person I'm talking to.
Yes. And, you know, and so here's my first question, and this is actually something that is brought to the surface from Larry's story, and I think, Larry, this is what you were getting to, that there is no out there, right? That it wasn't the company's fault. It wasn't the people's fault. You had to figure out what was in your way mentally. What was your sticking point internally? Is that right?
That's exactly right, Bert. I was fixated on everybody else being to blame for my problems, and it suddenly hit me that I was to blame. There was nobody else. I created the situation. I was feeding the situation. I was living the situation. Immediately I started digging in to find out, what can I do about this? I reenacted a network of old friends, consultants, professors, business associates, started working on, what is it I have to change? What about me changed from feeling successful to being a disaster? reading, going to workshops, et cetera, and eventually decided that I was going to get an executive coach. So I called around, asked people for references. Jackie was one of the people that was called out. I gave her a call. We had a very good discussion, and we went from there.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to ask Jackie this real quick. Jackie, do you find that what Larry's situation was, is that a pretty common situation that, you know, people are going along, they're doing everything that they used to do, life is great, but all of a sudden their results have shifted, they're not happening, they're not showing up the way they used to? Is that pretty common?
With a certain group of people, I mean, that's one scenario that shows up. Another scenario is, you know, I'm running as fast as I can, I'm doing as much as I can, and I'm not getting to where I want to get. Not that they've ever been able to get where they want to get. So Larry was an example of someone who'd had a lot of success and then had what we sometimes call it a disorienting dilemma or a fallback, and which causes the person to really then reassess what's happening. And as we always say, wherever you go, there you are. So you can try to get away from yourself, but there's really no getting away from yourself. And we all have blind spots, things that we do that sometimes get in the way or are creating barriers to the success we want to have.
Yes. No, that's amazing. You know, this thing that we sometimes create in our head, and all of a sudden it starts showing up, and here's Larry, he's working harder and harder and putting more time in, but yet nothing's happening. He's seeing all these, he's not seeing the results that he's used to seeing. So, okay, so Larry, going back to you, so you hire Jackie, and how quickly did you start seeing some changes? Was it pretty quick? Was it months? Talk a little bit more.
Well, time is relative. For me, it seemed like a long time, but the reality was I think I started to see results within the first couple of months. I became more energized, felt more clear about where I was going. I was much more honest, and she made me honest because she would call me on it. And, you know, I would start to deflect the blame back on other people. You know, he walks into the room and I get angry. He makes me angry. No, he doesn't make you angry. You brought that to the table yourself. She gave me pure, unadulterated feedback, and I needed it. I needed somebody to step in and stop me from deceiving myself, stop me from justifying myself and evaluating and judging others. She let me see who I really was and who I had become. Once that picture became clear, taking steps to change it seemed relatively easy. And Jackie and I have been doing this for quite some time now, and I still feel that I'm making changes. The interesting part was I went from someone, and this is feedback from the people that work for me, I went from someone who was referred to as the most hated man in the company to somebody that they now call for help and to bounce ideas off of. And that happened within 12 months.
Wow, that's incredible. From the most hated or most feared into a friend. Okay, go ahead, Jackie.
I was going to say I wanted to echo some of that, because what was really a learning for me, and it doesn't always happen this way. Sometimes as an external coach, you have access to other people in the organization, and sometimes you don't. And because of the way Larry's organization is, I had access to people at all different levels of the organization. And he's not exaggerating when he says he was not thought of as highly as one would want to be thought of. And
you don't have
was
to be politically correct, Jackie. Just say
well,
it.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, if we were, you know, we have a diverse audience out there, so, you know, I want to be careful. But, you know, I heard things like, you know, I wouldn't put water on him if he were on fire. That's what one person said.
Yeah.
And that,
wow.
You know, if he walked into the room, then another person said he would exit. And then fast forward now, Larry and I have now we've known each other now for a few years. Fast forward, it was about a year, year and a half, and I was talking to some of these same people and heard, Larry's the one I go to now when I need to get a reality check, boy, he has changed. Now I'm going to him and trying to figure out how did he change, because I want to change myself. I'm starting to see some of my own behaviors. And what we learn a lot of times when we do organizational work is that organizations are systems. They're not closed. They're impacted by all kinds of other things. So as people within an organization, we're impacted. Anything that we interact with impacts us. So once Larry started working on himself and became more collaborative and more communicative, more open, more transparent, more authentic, then that allowed people to also reciprocate, and when they couldn't, to ask, wow, what do I need to look at in myself that there's this block? And a few people had conversations with me about needing to look at themselves because they noticed the change. So he's not over-speaking when he says that. I think that executive coaching and having someone willing to look at themselves, it's quite extraordinary when it comes to transformational change and development.
Gotcha. All right, so let's talk about this. So, you know, because Larry's on the show, we're going to pick on Larry. So Larry comes to you.
Oh, yes,
and,
yes.
What? What was that?
I said, yes, let's pick on Larry, please.
And then the great thing about it is if somehow we impact his psyche, then you can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. So Larry is coming to you. He's having these challenges. What were some of the things that you had to work with Larry on or get Larry to see before he started to turn around? Does that make sense? Do you understand where I'm coming from?
I do. I think there are multiple levels. I liken it to an iceberg. So you have what's at the tip of the iceberg, which is the behavior. So what behaviors are you engaging in the organization? So he and I would talk about his behaviors, particularly when he was frustrated or agitated, because sometimes we're in a reactive state when that happens. And then you have what's at the waterline, which is what beliefs are fueling the behavior. So sometimes we would talk about what's the belief system at play. And sometimes we would talk about what's underneath the water, which is really the juggernaut, which has to do with our thinking patterns. What mental models do we have that are fueling the behavior? So the behavior, in essence, is like a roadmap to what our psychological processes are. And so we would work on what are the behaviors, what are the beliefs and the mindset triggering those behaviors, and then what are the values and the thought patterns, the mental models that you have going on. And working on all three levels, we were able to bring about change working collaboratively, because really Larry was the one in charge of his development, whether it would work or not. I was a thought partner and someone who would provide feedback. Sometimes we tell ourselves one thing and how we behave is a whole different way, and we're not aware of the dissonance there. And so we had to work on all three levels to really bring about some significant change.
Yeah, and that, you know, this is something that is so interesting, because again, here's a gentleman, i.e. Larry, who is running and gunning. He's at the top of his form. He's used to getting these great results. He's always been successful. And all of a sudden, something goes amiss.
Mm-hmm.
And the results that he is used to getting are no longer there. And so these changes have to take place. Larry, back to you real quick. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing that you said that I just want to correct a little bit is it's not that these things happen all of a sudden. These things tend to be happening all along the way. It's just we don't tend to notice them until something big enough grabs our attention. And so as Larry and I looked over what his history was, we found that there were that there was evidence along the way of some things that began to show themselves later. So I just wanted to change that because it isn't there's no big thing that it's like you're one way and all of a sudden you're another way. These mental models that are in place or outdated thinking, you start to see evidence of them along the way, and which is also how then changing into the way you want to be, if that's a process as well. So I just wanted to just add that in.
Throw that out there. Sure. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Larry, just real quick, so here you are, you decide I'm going to go with an executive coach, you chose Jackie. Do you remember the first aha, the first, or maybe it wasn't even aha, maybe it was the first thing that you didn't believe or didn't like, something that early on that maybe had an impact, either negative or positive?
Yeah, she gave me homework. We would have our session, and she would give me a homework assignment that I had to have done before the next session. Felt like I was back in school, but you know, I did it, and each time I did it, it helped me reveal something about myself, helped me learn something. I think the key, the big turnaround for me was, you know, I was a C-level executive. I was used to getting results. I was driven by results. The problem was I started to drive everybody around me to get those results, so I wasn't leading the people that worked for me. I was pushing them. I was focused on getting results that would lead to my success. And the aha moment was the recognition that if I really want to be successful, I have to set it up so that the people around me are successful. So that was the biggest aha. And then it became, how do I get there? How do I do that? And that was another whole series of books and workshops and hey, Jackies, and we need to talk.
Yeah, and you know what? And I could really see this from anybody who's a C level, anybody who considers himself a leader, who's running and gunning, to have somebody say, "Hey, I need you to do this homework for me." Yeah, that would put a little bit of what do you call it in my wheels as well. I'm like, "What do you mean homework? I'm an adult. You know, I'm running this company. I'm you know, homework."
Yeah, I think
all right,
my
Jackie,
thought was,
last word.
You're kidding me, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
I could definitely.
But
yeah,
you know, it was
that
all value-added because it made me dig deeper. Well, let me tell you, at the end of this, Bert, there's going to be a homework assignment.
So if you're listening to today's show, you're in luck. You're going to have a little homework after this. And so, Jackson,
that's right.
Tell us, what is our homework? Should we be doing if we're struggling or we're not getting the results or maybe we're the most hated person in our company? What are some of the things that we could be doing to maybe change that?
So one of the things, Bert, I believe very strongly in, and Larry and I have talked about this, is an accountability partner. That there's somebody that helps you that sometimes we need a mirror. And sometimes we need a window. Sometimes we need to be able to see ourselves, and sometimes we need to be able to look out. And having somebody that can help shed some light on our blind spots, things that we may not see that we're doing, or we have one intent and it has an impact that we didn't intend it to have. But having an accountability partner, what research shows is that success success is linked to accountability and support. The more you are much more likely to reach your goals, whatever they may be, if you have support and accountability. So if you are in an organization or you're not getting quite where you want to get or be where you want to be, having a partner where you can do a self-inventory. Am I doing everything in my power? And the tendency is, as Larry said, the tendency is to want to look at them. What they're not doing, the opportunities they're not giving, but you don't understand, the boss likes her better, the boss likes him better, to say, okay, where's my ownership? And having somebody to be able to partner with that, so you have a thought partner, I think is probably the greatest tool that you can have. And then investing in a coach or a mentor or someone that can help provide some direction if you're doing everything you can and it's not bringing up the results you want.
Yeah,
I think she's
I love
it.
Guys, go ahead, Larry. We got a couple seconds left. Go.
Okay, I was going to say that it's important, though, that if you have an accountability partner, that you listen to them and don't spend your time defending yourself or telling them that they're wrong. They're giving you honest feedback. You need to listen to it and really think about it.
Mm. I love it. I love it. And that is so true. Our egos, our pride can impede our progress, and that's a great example you just gave there, Larry. Larry Shaliga, Jackie Bashar, thank you so much for stopping by. Looking forward to have you guys back again soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks, Bert. Enjoyed it. Take care.
You bet. Good stuff there from Larry Shaliga, one of our regular contributors. And finding, as Jackie said, not only an accountability partner, but a supportive accountability partner, I think, is key. Remember, no matter what you're doing, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.